May it please the court. This this attorney discipline case has been fully tried. Every key witness has been examined and cross-examined, at least two public proceedings involving the one key fact issue, and that is, what did the respondent and his son know and reasonably believe when they used a credit card of the firm they were leaving to spend $6,700 to set up, to purchase items to set up a new firm? I think the court most probably knows the backstory. Respondent worked as an associate for his son, who's a partner at a Mexico, Missouri firm. The firm had for years one credit card that they all used, all the partners used for online purchases until 2010. At that time, the respondent, who was a CPA with an MBA and had been a long time chief financial officer of some hospitals, was the de facto firm manager in his son's stead. He recommended that they implement a new plan for each partner to have a credit card. His brief says the purpose for that was for ease of accounting and accountability amongst the shareholders in relation to tracking of overhead. So a couple months after that plan was implemented, respondent's son was involved in a fatal automobile accident, ended up being charged with manslaughter and leaving the scene of the accident. Tangentially, that's related because about 10 days after that accident, an unpleasant firm meeting was held, and the respondent and his son announced that they were planning to leave the firm. The respondent's son was the rainmaker of the pair and primary producer. Incidentally, the respondent's son was convicted of those felonies and was subsequently disbarred, so no discipline cases against the son have been presented here because he was already disbarred. He did get tried, and found guilty of fraudulent use of a credit device for his role in it. The respondent was not charged criminally in that case. With one major exception, the defense theory is in respondent's criminal case is the same as here. That is, they both claim that they believed that the new credit cards were personal cards that they could use as they saw fit, because respondent explains that he saw when he applied for the new cards online that he saw a pop-up screen that indicated that individuals might be held personally responsible. Here are the facts that refute that claim. Again, going back to his purpose was to set up ease of accounting for allocating between the partners for overhead. Second, to get the cards, he logged onto the firm's card account website for that particular account and clicked, I want three more cards. He provided no financial or personal information for any of the partners who the cards were going to be in their name. In fact, the new cards had the firm name on them. The firm office manager, not him, but the support staff office manager, received and paid the invoices for the new cards. She
can you address
held
that?
Because
I thought there was some argument that each card was actually paid for by that partner. What was charged on each card was paid out of that partner's draw.
Indirectly, yes. The support staff person paid the bill, then allocated each partner's expenses against his take that particular
and
amount.
So is that supportive of the respondent's argument that it would come out of his money, so he thought it was a personal card?
Well, it doesn't support that it's a personal card. It explains the process for allocating the expenses, and that it was done, that part was done by the firm. And it doesn't establish anything that it's his card.
The only firm money that went to pay the card was money that was due to him. Is that correct or is that incorrect?
Let me Try that again, I'm sorry.
Am I correct? I'm just trying to clarify the facts here, that the only firm money that went to pay his card was the money that was allocated to him, and other partners' cards was the money that was allocated to them?
I suspect that's a little bit of an overstatement, but generally so. I mean, I suspect there are some items that are purchased that were spread to the firm.
Okay.
I mean, spread to all of the partners because they were...
A copier or something.
Right, that sort of thing. The office manager herself retained the cards. The respondent never told the partners, at least the other partners, that they were going to be held personally responsible. He didn't produce any evidence of any documentary evidence or any kind of evidence that the other than his statement that the pop-up screen actually appeared or what was on it. And again, he testified he didn't go to the account website to set up personal cards. And of course, the firm had not approved the expenses, and the respondent did not ask for firm permission to make those expenses. The trial court in the criminal case rejected that theory, found it not credible, found the statements that they believed it not credible. The disciplinary hearing panel, in hearing the same facts, also rejected it and found those explanations not credible. The exception that I talked about the difference between the argument in that case, in the criminal case, and in this case, is that in 2013 at the criminal trial, the respondent testified after the statute of limitations had expired against him that this scheme, the plan, was his own, explaining that that he had the financial expertise of the two. And now, in his own case, when his son's already disbarred, he argues that he was only following his son's directives and that that should get him off the hook under Rule 4-5.2. Violations are, as found by the panel, assisting the son in the fraud and by participating in the fraudulent activity that we think that the court should find respondent guilty of those charges. We ask for an indefinite suspension without probation, with no leave to apply for at least 6 months. If we look at the ABA standards, and we look at the duty of the public was violated, in this case the firm, of course. The intent level is knowing, that's the statutory level, and that's what we think the evidence establishes. Every fact finder has found that. And what harm is here? We had $6,700 spent to compete against the firm by essentially borrowing against an unwitting lender, that is the old firm. When I call it the old firm, I don't mean to overstate it because at that time that was their firm, but they were already planning to leave. And the harm continued for 3 years. There was restitution 3 years later during the middle of the first day of the criminal trial. That apparently wasn't, at that point anyway, the offer wasn't tendered as a negotiated restitution in exchange for anything. Ultimately, because the prosecutor didn't deliver it or whatever, ultimately it did turn out to be a negotiated restitution. The firm agreed to offer to suggest leniency to the criminal court if they made restitution, if the respondent made restitution and made a written apology, which they did.
Now, the respondent argues that they made these charges thinking that there would be sufficient gross receipts coming in based upon past track record to cover these charges. And if, I assume there wasn't, but if there had been receipts sufficient enough to cover these charges, would we be here today?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the complainants apparently, as I read the record, apparently acknowledged that maybe they wouldn't have complained. I don't know that, I mean, for one thing, so maybe we wouldn't have been here because we're typically complaint-driven. But I don't know, I don't think it excuses anybody. It is at least a loan against the firm without the firm agreeing to the loan. To be used to compete against the firm. So at its best, even if we accept the theory that, that they knew that there was going to be money ready ready because they knew the past income, it's still borrowing against a hope that that income is going to keep coming, because the firm is responsible for the credit card because it's the firm's credit card. So the allocation, you know, that allocation system only works if there is enough income, and that's a bet.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if
the lender doesn't make those bets. Is the point?
Yeah,
at least, and they didn't make.
I wonder if that ever happened in the firm's history, that at some month during past years that situation would have ever occurred, and what was the firm's policy in that situation?
That is a good question. I don't know that's in the record. They did, as you suggest, say that they might not have made a complaint had there been enough money. So we argue that kind of sanction is appropriate. If you look at the ABA, specific ABA sanction standards, they're a little hard to apply. Look at 511, 512, and 513. 511 really is disbarment if there's intentional stealing of somebody else's money, intentional fraud. 512 says a suspension for knowing fraud if it's serious adverse effect on the victim. 513 would allow a reprimand if it's not serious adverse effect. We would argue, of course, that it is a serious adverse effect for the firm to lose $6,700, to spend hundreds of hours dealing with it, and then not get their money back until the day of trial 3 years later. Looking at some Missouri cases, it's not like the Kazanis case, the court may remember, where the lawyer actually stole from his firm, intended to hide it forever. I mean, I don't think there's any question that they knew they were going to have to pay it back, and it wasn't an outright attempt to steal and cover up and never pay it back. That's not the point. So it's not the same as that case. It's probably closer to the two couples cases where the lawyer hid files and ended up hiding some fees from his firm and probably knew that he was going to get caught as well, but he was going to be gone by then and hoped that he would pull it off. So again, we would argue that suspension is the an actual suspension is appropriate.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Before I launch into any kind of formal argument, there are a couple points that I want to make sure that I address. One is, and you may or may not have caught it in my first point relied on, there was obviously a word left out of that was not meant to be a concession in any way. When I stated in my brief that the respondent did violate rule 4-8.4a, obviously I meant to say he did not violate that rule. I left out the word not, so I just wanted to point that out. The other thing I want to address, while logically the issue of restitution and when it was tendered might be something for the end of this discussion, after a discussion about whether or not discipline is appropriate, I think the issue of restitution and how and when it was tendered is something that I don't want to lose and not get to. The criminal case involving respondent's son, I got in that case in May of 2013. Up to that point in time, the amount at issue between the Clampetts and the law firm was in dispute, and there was never an agreement of any kind as far as what an amount left owed was. We conducted extensive discovery, written discovery, June, July, and August, conducted depositions in September of 2013, and we were in trial in November of 2013. Obviously, that was a lot of discovery in a very complicated case in a short period of time. It wasn't until the completion of the depositions in September of 2013 that there was never an agreement as far as what the amount of restitution was. And it was only through the course of those depositions with one of the partners of the law firm and the bookkeeper at the law firm, that we were able to unravel what had been returned, what had been paid, because some of the items that were charged on the credit card actually were paid. $6,700 was just the amount that they were short in collections. Some of the items were actually paid in the normal course of business. So we got down to reach the $6,700 number, which was, by Mr. Platz's concession, Mr. Platz was the Assistant Attorney General who tried the criminal case, he conceded that that amount, $6,700, was about $1,000 less than what the law firm had originally claimed. So we established that number in September of 2013, and we showed up at the trial in November of 2013 with a cashier's check in hand. Now at the time, respondent's son was in the Department of Corrections. He was serving a sentence. He did not affect that restitution. Obviously, the restitution was affected by respondent. And we showed up, tendered the restitution, offered the restitution without any, without asking for anything, without any finding of guilt, without there being a determination that this was an amount owed by the court, was not compelled in any way. The respondent had, or the informant has, in their brief and before the disciplinary panel, argued that the offer or the payment of restitution should be given little, if any, mitigating weight because it was only paid as compelled restitution on the cusp of the eventual sentencing hearing, which didn't happen until I think it was February of 2000 or March of 2014. But that's not the case. And so to make sure that there wasn't a misunderstanding, I didn't get a chance to, or I didn't lose my chance to fully explain how and when that was tendered. It was tendered on the first day of trial, following the finding of guilt before there was ever a request from the law firm about a letter of apology or an agreement as far as them providing a letter of leniency on behalf of James A. Clampett. We tendered it again to Mr. Platz, and that is when he then took it to the law firm and more discussion was had about what might be done in conjunction with the payment of restitution, the letter of leniency. So that's how that came about. Now, the facts underlying the alleged misconduct in this case are largely not in dispute. If you read the respective statements of facts, they're not really all that much different. It's not disputed that respondent went to his son with the idea of, you know, we're going to leave the firm. We need to get these things to get our new firm up and running. Can we put them on the credit card? And whether he believed it was his son's credit card or whether he believed it was the firm's credit card, he went to a shareholder in the firm, a person whose name was on that card, a person with authority to give an associate permission to charge things on the card. He didn't do anything on his own. He didn't charge these things and then tell somebody else about it and said, well, I thought it would be okay because it was going to be paid at the end of the month. He went to a person with the authority to give him the authority to make charges on the card and asked, and his son said okay.
Mr. Yeah. Phillips, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Says that's not what he testified to at his son's trial, that he had a different story, but it was his idea, not that he was responsible for the decision to charge the cards. Is that correct?
No. No, it's not. The testimony and the evidence is that he went to the son and proposed the idea. It was, and I think their theory throughout has been of this disciplinary proceeding is that it was dad's idea, but he went to son, proposed it to him, and the son said okay. And I don't think that's in dispute.
Okay.
Now, in my mind, it's not.
This conversation that the son had with the shareholder, was that a conversation with Mr. Owings?
Yes.
And was that on about July 21st, 2010?
It was.
Okay. What was the date? At that point, hadn't charges already been made? So was it really a permission or was it forgiveness?
Well, the knockdown dragout meeting when they decided that they were going to leave was June 21st. Okay. The accident was June 13th of 2010.
And this conversation was July 21st, a month after the...
A month later, several of the charges had been made. And the way it came about, the son acknowledged to Mr. Owings that charges had been made.
It wasn't that
something had been discovered.
Yeah. So I guess my point, question to you then is, how would it be asking permission if charges had already been made?
I'm saying that Dad went to his son, a shareholder, and asked him if it was okay to
and
charge
that was back in June? Or
that
was
back
it?
In June before any charges were made.
Okay, I thought you said that the son went to Mr. Owings on July 21st.
No, I meant, I don't know what I said.
That's okay.
what I meant was that Dad went to his son and asked him permission. Dad was the associate. He went to a shareholder. He asked permission.
Okay.
He got it. And then the charges were made.
What was the date that the new firm was going to be started? What was the date of severance of the old firm? Was there a date established?
Originally, it was thought that there would be a 2 or 3 month time frame. And as you can imagine, things were tense and increasingly tense. So while I think that when they first announced their departure, it was in their mind that they would have 2 or 3 months, as things got more tense and heated, it was decided that the date was going to be July 31st.
Okay,
August
so they
1st.
Were actually members of the firm when they made these charges on the firm account.
They were.
Okay.
And they knew that these things, they knew that this credit card statement was going to come into the firm. They knew that these charges were going to be on there. They knew that it was going to be put into the accounting detail. And what's really important is that one of the charges was made in June. The first charge on the credit card was made in June for a Clampett Law related item. That charge was made in June. It was put into the June accounting detail and it was paid for in the normal course of business, just like they expected the July charges would be. What really isn't fully explained in the brief, well, it isn't addressed in the brief, but it is in the record. And the reason why they didn't have an idea of a clear idea of what the July collections were going to be was that up until that June 21st meeting, James A. Clampett's practice was to take retainers when they came in as earned fees. So, and there was a decision came down about the same time that said that was not the proper way to handle retainers, that they were to be held in trust and only drawn down as the work was done. But up to that point in time, it was kind of an open question as to whether that was an acceptable practice or not. At the June 21st meeting, Mr. Ertl made it clear to Mr. Clampett that that practice was not going to continue. And I think Mr. Ertl's main problem with that was he was afraid that if these guys were gone, they were going to be left doing work and not, there would be no money for them to bill against. So the collections in every month up until June were handled that way. July was the first month where they didn't have, they didn't have any money to bill against. And also they were hoping that their practice was going to succeed. They were still practicing law. There hadn't been any adverse action against them yet, but believe it or not, in a small town of Mexico, after the accident of June 13th, there wasn't as much business coming in the door in late June and July to the local attorney who everybody in town knew was charged with manslaughter. And so I don't think they thought through that in advance of making the decision, nor did they to make the charges on the credit card, nor did they have any reason to know how good business was going to be. Certainly they were hopeful.
Isn't that theory as to what happened, that they knew it was the firm credit card and they expected it to be paid out of income that would come in, different than what was presented to at the DHP hearing over it, him thinking that it was a personal credit card, which the DHP did not believe?
Not different, no. Whether it was a personal credit card or the firm credit card, They still believe that the firm is going to be out nothing because it was going to be paid for at the end of the month. Yes, it was. It has been the testimony that he believed it was Sun's card, but that wasn't the only theory that was presented at the DHP. It was also that we had every reason to believe, based upon past collections, that this was going to be paid for in the normal course of business, no matter whose card it was.
Is there some inconsistency, I think, between thinking it was a personal card and thinking it was going to be paid in the normal course of business? If it's paid with firm money or firm receipts, not out of his personal checking account, it's not a normal personal card.
Not a normal personal card. It was a card that was paid for through the operation and business of the firm. Whether that was a personal credit card, whether it was football tickets that was approved, whether it was membership dues at the YMCA, doesn't really make any difference. The point is that that's the way that credit card was handled, and that they expected it to come out of their collections. The accounting of the firm, in a way, there is no such thing as firm money. I mean, money comes in and is held for a month, and they settle up at the end of every month, and there's things that are paid for and shared equally amongst the partners, but there isn't any firm money. They all are responsible for their own expenses based upon their own collections. I think it's extremely significant that before he did anything, he asked a shareholder whether it was okay to make these charges. The shareholder told him that he could. There was nothing dishonest, fraudulent, deceitful about the conduct upon which they want to take discipline. And since I'm running out of time, I will ask you to consider the same thing that the disciplinary hearing panel concluded after hearing all of the evidence and hearing all of the witnesses testify for nearly an entire day, that the public does not need to be protected from the respondent. His conduct was maybe a violation of the ethical rules, but not grossly so, that a reprimand is an appropriate sanction if discipline is appropriate at all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Phillips, you're probably going to address this, but in response to what the respondent just said, the DHP thought that it's the public that doesn't need protection. It's a squabble between members of a law firm.
Sure.
Why does this raise to the heightened level of actual suspension in your office's view?
Dishonesty is the short answer. I mean, because it involves dishonesty, we think that we have to address it in this system as well. But I'll go a little bit further than that. It's not just the public that needs protection, although if the respondent doesn't get it, doesn't acknowledge that he's done anything wrong, then the public may need protecting. But even if you don't agree with me on that one, that's not the only reason we have these proceedings, is to protect the public. We also have to protect the integrity of the profession, both inside the profession and outside the profession. And if the lawyer is involved in dishonesty with a firm, then the court has taken action, discipline action.
But if I understand, just to make clear, when you're saying dishonesty, it's my understanding you're not suggesting that he hid these expenses and tried to have them paid by firm allocations beyond his, and they were right there on the record, so he wasn't hiding what he did. The firm would know, looking at their billing, that this was something he was responsible for. But your point is that he should have known that once they decided to leave, that the others in the firm, if he'd asked, would have said, don't do that.
Right. And you know, and frankly, asking the co-conspirator, so to speak, hardly seems the it seems like an inside job.
If they weren't related, it would have been okay. It's the relationship.
Well, if that person's leaving with you, then I don't know, the familial relationship doesn't matter. I mean, the relationship that they were the ones who were leaving is the problem. The fact they were.
Are you suggesting they should have had no reasonable expectation that the partners who were going to stay there were going to finance their next law practice? That whole idea.
I think yes.
That there was no reasonable expectation that, given the opportunity to say whether they would approve that or not, that they would do so.
Right, which is what the trial court wrote in the criminal case in that judge's conclusion.
And does the record show that there was a finding as to whether the firm credit card could have been properly used for individual personal expenses as opposed to for firm expenses?
I'm not exactly sure, but I think the answer is
exacerbated by it being to start a new law firm.
Right.
But is there evidence as to whether one could purchase your
football
tickets, now that were not firm expenses?
Right. And I don't know. I'm not sure exactly. I know that the record supports the idea that perhaps event tickets had been purchased in the past and recovered. What I don't know is whether those were marketing. I mean, taking
event
client
tickets
or,
say right. I want a new dress. There's something totally personal, like the expenses for starting a new firm. Is there anything in the record as to whether there was a reasonable belief, there was something to support a reasonable belief that you could charge personal expenses to a firm credit card?
Right, and I don't know. I mean, I know that, like, at some level there were things that were personal, but I don't know how far it went, whether it included, you know, clothing that wasn't going to court clothing. I'm not sure.
I don't think my firm ever paid for my suits, so that would be personal.
Well, your opponent mentioned, like, YMCA membership.
That one was specifically in the monthly charge that was drawn from.
And it was a membership for one of the partners, one of the shareholders?
Yes.
Okay.
It may have been there for all of them. I don't know. I didn't see the other.
Do you consider that personal?
Well, some agencies don't.
Yeah. Okay. That's okay.
But some do. I mean, it's part of the health plan of the firm nowadays. Thank you.
Thank you. The case will be submitted.